Hello, everyone. I'm Kelsey Forrest, and I'm here tonight with dark journalist Daniel List to go deep into the mystery of the Hot Zone, Atlantis Rising, and an ancient connection to exotic technology.
It's great to be here with you, Kelsey.
Are you ready for this?
Yes.
Okay, I'm diving right in. So what is the Hot Zone? Because that's going to be the big question. Where is it located? And what discoveries have been made there that make it so controversial?
Yeah, you know, this is really fascinating. Probably the most fascinating line of research that I've been involved with doing the X series. And it all has to do with an area that is between Miami on one hand, Bimini on the other, the western tip of Cuba, and the Yucatan Peninsula. Now, this area attracted me in a number of ways, because I'd always heard stories about ruins being found there. And there's all kinds of rumors about things that had been discovered there, including pyramids underwater, and vastly more interesting things. So over time, I also came in the UFO research to realize this is a UFO hotspot. Whenever you get around the Bahamas, you have the largest amount of UFO sightings.
I've had no one's connecting that to the Bahamas right now.
This is the crisscross, indeed. Yeah. So when you get those two mysteries going at the same time, watch out. And what I discovered when I was doing the shows on it, and we did 12 different episodes on the Hot Zone, was that people were contacting me and saying, well, I've worked in the military, and, you know, when I was down there, they said, if you discover any ruins or if you see any major, you know, if the Temple of Isis is down there, here's your NDA. You can't sign that. You know, you can't disclose that. So this was a kind of a warning flag for me whenever I get around research when they're telling you don't disclose to the public. You know, you're onto something. But the Hot Zone became much richer than that the more I got into it. And the more episodes I did on it, more people would come out of the woodwork. And this term, the Hot Zone, is something I got from their referral when they were saying, you know, I was down there, I was mapping the ocean floor, and there was an area that they said, stay away from. And if you see anything down there, you know, large-scale ruins, anything like that, you know, it's actually, in the military, it's a court-martial offense, but for a private company, it's revealing their company secrets. You can go to jail for that. You can get sued for that.
So not a lot of people are going to step up.
Yes.
Which,
I was fascinated to get as much response. And, you know, it reminds you, whenever you get around whistleblowers, there's always something for them to lose, you know. And so you go gentle with it. You try to keep them as anonymous as possible. But I could see here that these people had long stretches in different types of either military or private careers or oil research, geology, whatever it happened to be. And I started to combine that with the research around everything to do with the Hot Zone. And as it turned out, I found, when I looked deeply, a number of scientists involved there in very deep research on archaeology that nobody knows anything about, one. Mm-hmm. Two, I found high-level figures going back over decades, everyone from Ernest Hemingway on one hand all the way up to Ghislaine Maxwell.
You have a lot of names to discuss.
Tonight, we're going to get deep into it. There's no question around it. So the Hot Zone became, for me, something which, the more I looked into it, the more it opened up. And here we are tonight. I can tell you the four factors that go into it, and it involves the lost civilization of Atlantis. This is a major part of it all. As a matter of fact, the Ghislaine Maxwell aspect is due entirely to the fact that the group that she was surrounded by were very interested in this Belial character, and they had a cult of Belial down there on St. James Island, Little St. James. So this played hard into it, but the story's much, much older. And so all the stories of Hemingway in Bimini, in Cuba, well, I found out that Lester Hemingway, Hemingway's brother, had founded something called New Atlantis by buying lots in a certain piece of the Bahamas and saying, land is going to rise here, and we're going to call it New Atlantis. He got it as a whole status. And the more I dug into it, and I know we'll get into the Edgar Cayce readings tonight from the psychic sleeping prophet Edgar Cayce, but the more I got into it, I realized, oh, the Hemingways and the Cayces go way back. He's been doing readings for that family for years. So, you know, Cayce died in 1945, And before he died, he did all of these extraordinary readings about the island of Bimini and how it had a big, major relationship to this concept of ancient Atlantis and the advanced technology that they had back then. So this is where I found myself in the middle of it, Hemingway and Casey back then, and then in modern times, people like Marvin Minsky, the founder of AI, working with Ghislaine Maxwell on the same thing. So there's a thread there. As we get through it, we find the people and the nature of the situations. And so we know we're in very deep territory.
Very. What is the relationship between the hot zone, Atlantis, advanced technology, and the psychic readings of the 20th century sleeping prophet Edgar Casey?
Casey's fascinating. First of all, he's the most well-documented psychic of all time. This was a guy who was born in Kentucky, and he was a Sunday school teacher, in fact. But he's known now as the father of holistic medicine. And he would go deep into these trances and basically be able to diagnose someone at a distance. And so he created all, you know, different types of herbology. He, you know, spawned chiropractic, all these different fields were right there as a basis of his readings. And it was quite extraordinary. The way he discovered his powers was because he lost his voice at a young age. And he was an insurance salesman at 19 years old. And there was someone who was a hypnotist who was trying to help him regain his voice. And when he went into these trances, he diagnosed himself by going over his body and saying what was wrong. And people learned about him, came to him and said, well, you know, I have this ailment or I have that ailment. This is how the whole Casey legend started. He didn't do anything about lost civilizations or reincarnation or any of that stuff in the beginning. And the doctors didn't know what to make of him either. You know, there's a New York Times article from 1910 when he's very young doing these psychic readings. And they're like, we don't know where this guy's getting this information. So it's a very erudite level that he's getting in this psychic trance. Years later, we understand things like, you know, remote viewing and how the government has paid for programs of these psychics to get together, remote view a location and come back and give them the information. Well, Edgar Casey was doing this way before the government even had a program around it. And so at a certain point, he starts to go into retrocognition, going back in time. And he starts to say that there was an advanced past going on way, way far before the traditional history that we're aware of, and that Egypt was a legacy culture, and so on. So now there's a string of researchers who followed up on that, and Casey's dating from the 1920s and 30s is starting to become more and more the standard dating, because in archaeology, things keep getting older. Somehow, Casey, in his trance state, knew this, and he's right in the heart of the hot zone story.
That's so interesting. What is the Atlantean Hall of Records and the Two-Eye Stone in the Casey psychic readings, and how does it fit into the entire investigation?
Well, this is fascinating because in Casey's work, he talks about the fact that this ancient advanced culture in Atlantis, and, you know, we have Atlantis, I should say, traditionally in the Plato story. He talks all about, well, there was this fabulous continent there, and they were the most advanced, and, you know, they came in, and the Athenians kind of, you know, had war against them, and they succeeded. And if you go into that Plato story, it's pretty wild, because what happens is the story was passed down by a relative of Plato's named Solon, and he went to Egypt originally and got the story from them. And if you read the actual Timaeus that Plato wrote in that period, he says that Atlantis went down 9,000 years before he's writing, which is around 400 BC. So now we have a date there, 9400 BC, where the destruction of Atlantis happens. So there's a lot of, you know, kind of mythical talk about it. You know, in one day and night it disappeared and the gods were angry with it and this kind of thing. But then if you start to put yourself in the mindset of an advanced culture being there in that period of time, then you start to realize, how would they interpret it by the time you get around to the Greeks? And it's a 9,000-year-old story. You might be using a lot of this, well, the gods, you know, angered. But the Atlanteans were the most superior group, and they had advanced technology, and they ran the planet. That's the way that Plato describes them. So when you get into Casey's readings, when he's going back and tapping into this Atlantean piece, he's saying, Well, the Atlanteans, after they were going down, you know, the continent was going down, they went to different places. They went to Egypt, they went to Peru, they went to Mexico, and they placed halls of records of different types about the experience of the Atlanteans, their technology, their beliefs, and they hid them for future generations. This is where Casey is tapping into it. In the middle of all that is a reference to something called the Two-Eye Stone. So we'll spell it out here because this is Casey spelling in each reading. It's always in capital letters, so he must have said it loudly. T-U-A-O-I. So I went and investigated. It's a very odd word. And I spent some time investigating it. And it came up as a word about stone. So when you say the Two-Eye Stone, it means people of the stone, people of the crystal, basically. And what he said was that there was a worldwide network that was like an energy network, basically, that these ancient groups had put together, and they used the Two-Eye Stone in order to do it. And the way that he described it and the advances that he gave to people back in the ancient antediluvian past didn't make a whole lot of sense to historians and people like that who were like, well, you know, you got cave people, and then you got hunter-gatherers, then you got to the pyramids, and then you get to us, you know. He's got it, no, there's an advanced culture, then you have a legacy culture in Egypt, you have a legacy culture in the Mayans, and the hint of it is a major earth destruction earlier on, so we record it as the Great Flood. So here Casey is saying the Two-Eye Stone is what the Atlanteans used to power their civilization, the same way we use electricity or nuclear power. And it was by setting the Two-Eye Stone too high, and the, you know, the whole network too high, that brought down the island of Atlantis. This is Casey's story in the 1920s, very early on. But he's saying, look, the major center of Atlantis was right there in the Bahamas, where Bimini is. And that gets us into the next level of where Casey was going as far as Bimini and what he called Poseidia, which was the major center in Atlantis, and these ruins that he predicted that eventually arose and are now, you know, called the Bimini Wall, and everyone knows them. They're off the coast. They're an anomaly off of Bimini. But Casey predicted it in 1932. So it leaves us in a strange place.
Yeah. There are some famous historical figures related to the Hot Zone that you've identified in your research as being linked to the secret programs. Let's start with the Nobel Prize-winning novelist Ernest Hemingway.
Hemingway, wow.
Who knew? He's here.
This is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
What's funny is this is multi-generational with the Hemingway family. That's also interesting because Grace Hemingway, Hemingway's mother, is a regular student of Edgar Casey's. Now, if you go into Hemingway, aside from his legendary novels and all the rest of it, you're going to find two interesting things. Most of his life as an adult, after he came back from Paris and all that, is spent in two places, Bimini and Cuba, both Target Central in the Hot Zone. And, you know, he grew up in Idaho. But when he's in Cuba, he spends all this time there building up a cachet of research. And what he does is he takes his boat out between Bimini and Cuba, and he goes back and forth, and nobody knows what he's doing. So it's not a fishing boat, this one. You know, he's famous for fishing out there. But he has all this incredible scientific gear on board, and he is surveying the ocean floor. Now, Lester Hemingway, his younger brother, is a newspaper person, and he is in these little submarines going around in the Hot Zone in the bottom also. So they're putting together a lot of images and information about something that's down there in the Hot Zone. So Hemingway is getting readings through his mother from Edgar Casey. Casey brings up Bimini and these temples and the ancient culture that's there. And Hemingway moves to Bimini, and he moves to Cuba, which are these areas that Casey is identifying as the former, you know, kind of the highlands, the mountaintop ranges of this lost continent. So now we have this direct tie over, and it's funny to think about the nature of the relationship between the Caseys and the Hemingways, which is something that we brought out in the Hot Zone, in the X series, doing the Hot Zone episodes. It's never been, nobody had ever mentioned it. And it's funny because if you go back there and look, you're going to find there are letters from Casey's son writing to his mother saying, oh, I'm coming down there to spend some time in Oak Park, Illinois. They're in Virginia Beach. And he's talking about going to Oak Park, Illinois, and spending a month with you. Well, we know when we go to spend time with good friends, you know, we'll spend some time with it. What kind of friends do you have where you spend a month with them? That's pretty close.
Yeah.
So the Hemingways and the Caseys are like that. Casey's doing the psychic readings. Hemingway has kind of a double life. He is a famous novelist on one hand. On the other hand, there's a lot of intelligence networks, like the Central Intelligence Agency, that regard him as an intelligence network of his own, to the point where his own son, who will become a CIA agent, and Hemingway will be afraid of him in the 50s, him growing up and him being a CIA agent, because Hemingway has something else that's going on. So we find ourselves in the Hot Zone with Casey and with Hemingway now, and this starts to give us some idea that there's something very special going on in this area that we found out is called the Hot Zone.
That just keeps building upon.
It does.
There's so much more.
The Hemingway thing is worth, you know, a dozen episodes on its own.
Yes.
It's quite remarkable.
So, what is the mystery school connection of anthroposophist Rudolf Steiner, theosophical leader Helena Blavatsky, to the modern awakening of Atlantis? And what is the possibility that our ancestors possessed advanced technology that we never even knew?
Yeah, this is fascinating, isn't it? How much would it change our story if there was advanced technology back there? You know, we know about the pyramids, we know about the Sphinx, and they do all these things, and they're like, you still can't put a credit card between the stones and the pyramid. And they know it's advanced, and they know that they're, you know, the Mayans had advanced astronomy. Where did all that come from? You know, I think about the Piri's map, and this is by the Turkish admiral, and he has it in 1502. That map that we have now, and there's no doubt about its authenticity, shows the entire globe as if by satellite. So we know that somebody was operating back there with the ability to look down, and that, you know, it's a very old thing. And it's interesting because they asked him in his own time period, where'd you get this? You know, how'd you do it? And he said, well, this map is old. It's from a monastery, and it actually is from the time before Christ. So they're getting the further back you go, just like in the Egyptian civilization, the more advanced the culture is. That doesn't add up to the traditional evolutionary track. So we're in very different, we have to look at it differently. So when you get around the mystery schools, they're giving us in the 19th century and then into the 20th century some kind of foundation about Atlantis that wasn't there before. So in Theosophy, Helena Blavatsky is talking about Atlantis, and she's saying we had an advanced culture back there. It went down. People went to different places. They went to Africa. They went to Iceland. They went to America. And they kept remnants of the story of an advanced culture that existed at one point. Plato's story plays into all that. But they made a really strong emphasis on it. When you get into Steiner's work, he goes even deeper. So he has a book called Cosmic Memory, which talks about how the people who had developed Atlantis, and this is, gets into a cosmology, were reincarnating now, and that they were building the same fast technology situation that blew them up back then. So he's warning about this. Now, somebody could look at him, you know, I mean, this is a guy who's an amazing scholar. He probably could have saved himself the trouble by not getting into these things. But he did, and if you look at his work now, and we're talking about the 1920s again, Steiner's predicting things like the internet for the 21st century. He talks about the eighth sphere, and this thing sounds so much like Meta and artificial intelligence that it's like he's looking into the future directly. So there aren't a lot of explanations for how they're doing it, but all of this comes out of that mystery school milieu. And Casey, right on top of it, he comes right after Steiner, right after Blavatsky, and here he is. He does 900 readings on Atlantis, talking about this advanced culture using a 2i power network around the globe and then destroying their own continent. And that all those stories after the fact are remnants. And what we're going to find is that a lot of scientists in the 20th century and now took him very seriously, not publicly, but they did a lot of research on what he was seeing. And we're going to see how this plays off into some of the AI battles that we're looking at right now.
There are plenty.
Advanced technology, right? Or you say exotic technology. This is exactly, you know, this is the field that we're in now. Who's got the technology and how far ahead of the public is it? This is the nature of the thing we tackled when we were doing the Apotheum episode. Apotheum plays right into the hot zone as well.
It's all there.
It does.
So drilling down further into Casey's cosmology of Atlantis, who are the Sons of Belial and the Law of One group?
This is fascinating. Casey's story of Atlantis works something like this. There's a group there, the Law of One group, who he calls the Emilius group at times.
Why is that?
Because Emilius is kind of the founder. He's almost like the Christ figure for the Emilius, the Law of One group. And the Belial plays very much like an evil archetype. So it's kind of like, you know, good Emilius versus evil Belial. Mm. And it's very interesting because when we go into some of the rediscovery of Belial by these scientists and the lust for AI and things of this nature, you're going to find that there's a Belial cult that's very active that plays right into some of the research and reporting we've done on Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein. And they were deep, deep into the cult of Belial. But Casey's story takes us back into this period where the Emilius group developed the 2i technology. And the way that he describes it is that they interacted with the outer spheres, the higher planes, using the technology. This is what they built it for. And so, you know, you open up your laptop, you talk to an ascended master. I mean, you know, it's this kind of a relationship to the technology. It's got none of the overhangs of war or anything like that. So it's a very peaceful spiritual technology. As a matter of fact, he said that they used it to communicate with the saintly realm. So, and they trained their priestesses to do it. And, you know, he gives a series of readings in this retrocognitive state going back thousands of years. And you find echoes of it later in the Egyptian culture when they are, you know, doing sun worship and things of this nature. It goes back to this Emilius group. What happens is sometime during that development of Atlantis, the Belial group gets their hands on the technology. And they use it for other purposes. They're not the spiritual-minded Emilius group. They use it to, you know, destroy other continents and things like
that. There was no peace.
They're dropping bombs, yeah. And what he says is that they take the 2i power stations and they tune them too high, and it splits the island into three islands. Now, this is echoed in the Plato work, so Casey is tapping in here a little bit. And he names the three islands Og, Arion, and Poseidia. Poseidia is the one that's in the Bahamas, and this is kind of the focus of our hot zone piece. But those three islands are at war, and it's this Law of One group, Emilius group, versus the Belial group, who are using the technology, you know, as a kind of might makes right, as Casey puts it. And we'll read a quote later to pinpoint exactly what Casey had to say about it. But for me, it's very clear that a lot of the echoes that we hear later about groups coming down, raining things down from the sky, could very well be a group back then that had an advanced technology that was doing firebombing and all the rest of it. And it comes back to us as a myth of, you know, here's a Hindu myth of them throwing lightning bolts from the sky or something like that. Well, you know, in India, they talk about the Vimanas, and those are flying machines, and there's no explanation for why they have records like that. So somebody has the technology back there. And I think that's where this goes. Another example I'll use is the Nazca Lines. And the Nazca Lines, if you are flying over Nazca in Peru, they can only be seen from the air. So we didn't even see these until, you know, modern times when we had flight. before that, they could only, you know, you couldn't, you could walk around them. You wouldn't even notice it. What happened, and it's interesting, is they realized, oh yeah, we can see these amazing things. You know, the spider motif, this monkey, this bird, these unusual figures, but we can only see them from the air. So they're meant to be seen from the air. So somebody is operating flight. There's no question about it. And we didn't even discover or rediscover flight until the Wright brothers, technically. Mm-hmm. So therefore, if you have that kind of technology back there, then there's a missing chapter in all of this. That's why when you get around the hot zone, there's a lot of intrigue involved. Some of it's geopolitical, and some of it has to do with the basis of the human origin story. Maybe it's a lot different than Sumeria 6000 BC and all the rest of it. And it's interesting because, you know, they used to, in scientific circles, kind of laugh off the Casey work. And they said, well, he says the Egyptians were operating in 10,000 BC. That's not possible. You know, they showed up around, you know, 4,000, 3,000 BC. And they didn't build the pyramids till 2,500 BC. So it's about 8,000 years of difference between Casey's version of Egypt and traditional archaeology. Well, in the last 10 years, they've discovered Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. And guess what? It's 10,000 BC, so it's 12,000 years old. It's well-developed, it's a whole culture, and it's in Turkey, which is pretty close to Egypt last time that I checked. So therefore, all of these things that we've grown up with, the traditional dating systems, keep getting pushed back, and Casey's work keeps getting more and more validated, which means what he's saying about Atlantis, if we take a look at it, the advanced technology existed back then. So we have a real conundrum, which is how did it go from super advanced to super primitive? And how does that bring us around to smart old us with nuclear missiles and Wi-Fi and AI?
Yeah. Well, yeah, most recently AI. Okay.
AI is going to come up tonight, make no mistake.
Well, so what are archaeology wars and why is the deep state interested in the hot zone and ancient ruins?
This is fascinating. Archaeology wars happen. They're not reported on. There's something you have to look for, but they're pretty easy to find. So if you go into a lot of World War II, you'll find Hitler, for example, and the Nazi Party invading different places, looking for sacred objects. One of them was the Spear of Destiny, which was supposedly the spear that pierced Christ. Hitler was obsessed with it and wanted to go into Austria for the purposes of getting it, risking all this geopolitical stuff to get the Spear of Destiny. They have an entire division in the Nazi occult looking around the world for sacred objects. Now, in Sumeria, there are all of these tales of them burying weapons that were too powerful to destroy. And all of these different groups developed an attachment to finding out about this. So the archaeology wars, you can find them, and you can find these groups battling over the different spoils of war. One of the most famous examples is when the Iraq War happened, and there was all this looting of the Baghdad Museum. But since the American forces were there, it never needed to happen. So somebody wanted people to go into that Baghdad Museum for something. And if you track back through that, you're going to find, well, there are relics there in Baghdad that were connected with this idea of archaeology wars. When you get into the hot zone, you are looking at a series of groups operating around the hot zone, looking to be the ones who have that sacred connection. But they have another reason for it, which is they think it'll give them some kind of advantage. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One example, which I found fascinating, comes out of a CIA record. The CIA in 1964 infiltrated the Edgar Casey ARE, the Association for Research and Enlightenment, their group, in 64 in Virginia Beach. And they sent in their agents to get information about the Hall of Records, the very thing that we're talking about tonight. Somehow that record existed and was declassified. I have it. And there's a series of things about it. They have a whole program for finding Noah's Ark. So the archaeology wars are something that go on between nations. It's not widely publicized, but they're there. When you get to the hot zone, it's at its maximum secrecy. And what I've learned about it is there's so many tensions involved. There's China, there's Venezuela, there's Cuba, there's the United States. And nobody seems to be able to figure out, why is there so much tension when you get down there? You know, sometimes they think about, it's about trafficking drugs. You know, we have all these stories about banana republics and how the CIA got in there and controlled different areas. Well, that's true, but it doesn't explain that it's constantly a source of tension. So there's a guy, a British intelligence officer named Egerton Sykes, who had the most vast library of Atlantis. And he came out after he retired and said, look, they have ruins down there in the Bahamas. And they know that there are ruins that fit a profile of ancient Egypt down there. And that changes the equation. And you have groups that are huddled around trying to be the first one to exploit that particular discovery. Now, the discovery may go a lot deeper than them just wanting first dibs at ancient ruins. But it's a factor. And so we have the deep state archaeological wars going on on a regular basis. And you know, unless you happen to trip into it, as I did with the hot zone research, you're not going to find it. But it's there if you look.
Okay. So this is my big question.
Yes.
How do scandalous figures like former socialite and convicted sex trafficker Ghislaine Maxwell and the late criminal financier Jeffrey Epstein fit into the labyrinth of dark connections?
This was probably the most amazing aspect when I got into the hot zone research, when these characters were popping up.
What is going on?
And I got lucky. I'll tell you how I got lucky. So a big part of this case, and of course, you know, the case of Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein, you know, Epstein didn't kill himself and all the rest of it. They were involved in this heavy duty, on the surface, sex trafficking ring, blackmail, etc. But if you go even a half inch deep, you can see it's already about something more than that, because her dad ran for many years scientific publication and a publishing house, and they raised billions of dollars for things like research on Atlantis, for example, and published books on the seafloor around Bimini, things of this nature. So right off the bat, I knew we were into something. But sometimes when you're doing research, you get a break. And I got a tremendous break when Virginia Giuffre's testimony against Prince Andrew came out. Now, she was one of the people who the Epstein-Maxwell team trafficked, and one of the figures they trafficked to was Prince Andrew. It's a public trial, and he ended up paying money for it to go away, or loaning money from the king, as it were. But nonetheless, if you go through that transcript, you're going to find two interesting names in their blackmail list. And so Giuffre was saying they would set me up with these high-level people, these scientists. They would appoint me to go to them, show up in their hotel room, you know, have all the salacious stuff happen, and then come back and give them the info. They also would, you know, and sometimes they would videotape it and all the rest. So these are the things that they were up to. And you looked at some of the people on the list, and then most of the people on the list, you know, they wouldn't even mention. But one of the people that grabbed me when I was looking at it was Marvin Minsky. Marvin Minsky is the creator of AI, and he's was at MIT for years and years. And I started to find all these pictures of Epstein with MIT Marvin Minsky. That was the first very strange name on that list. And I knew that they had a background of working with scientists. And I wondered about exactly why were they working with scientists so heavily on this scientific trip if they were just some kind of weird spy blackmail political ring. So Minsky, as it turned out, had a very interesting best friend. Minsky's best friend was Margaret Sanders, who was the daughter of Colonel Sanders of Kentucky Fried Chicken fame, the Colonel. I did an episode called The Colonel in the Hot Zone over this. So at one point, if you go deep on Ghislaine Maxwell, you're going to find the Maxwell Epstein team entertaining none other than Stephen Hawking. And we can actually look at him. That's Hawking on Epstein Island, in fact. Interestingly enough, Hawking was down there, and he was suited up in a specially made submarine that Epstein and Maxwell had put together called Atlantis. He was down there. He wasn't down at Orgy Island, you know, to have a party. He was down there to be part of the scientific group observing something down there in the hot zone. Now, Minsky, whose friend was Margaret Sanders, when you go into Margaret Sanders, you're going to find her at the very heart of Atlantis research. When I mentioned Egerton Sykes, who was the British intelligence agent who said, well, there are all these ruins down there in the hot zone, she was his secretary.
Okay.
And she was already a millionaire, so she didn't need to be anybody's secretary. But she wanted to be there at the heart of his Atlantis work. So she had a son who was a pilot named Trigg Adams, and he's one of the people who discovered the Bimini Wall. So he's big back then as a very young man, finding all these Atlantean ruins, and she's investing all this money and time into a group called MARS, which is all about archaeological research there around Bimini. So she's deep in the hot zone. She's deep in with the Casey Foundation. As a matter of fact, she gives lectures at the Casey Foundation. But she's best friends with Marvin Minsky. Minsky is getting all this intel about her Atlantis research directly from his best friend. And the Epsteins are trying to blackmail Minsky. That made me very suspicious about exactly what was going on down in the hot zone. The next thing that opened up around Margaret Sanders and Minsky, if you go into that Virginia Giuffre testimony again, which was her testimony about what the Epstein-Maxwell team did to have her do all this stuff with Prince Andrew, in that court case, you're going to find on record her saying, well, one of the people that they targeted was Alexandra Cousteau. Let me tell you how strange it is to have Alexandra Cousteau in the middle of all this. They go after scientists, they go after millionaires, political figures. Alexandra Cousteau is the granddaughter of Jacques Cousteau, whose lifelong quest was to find Atlantis. He's the ultimate guy who did all the specials for years and years, the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau, documentaries, movies, TV specials, everything. Why would they want Alexandra Cousteau? And the whole idea Giuffre was saying is they wanted her in a compromising situation so they could blackmail her. And Cousteau is very interesting in this regard because apparently the Maxwell pattern of blackmail has something going. First we have Minsky and Colonel Sanders' daughter, Margaret. Well, now Cousteau is the granddaughter of basically the man who knows the most about Atlantis.
Yeah.
Jacques Cousteau is dead, but Alexandra's a young woman who runs an ocean nonprofit. The reason they wanted to have blackmail on Alexandra Cousteau is because they wanted what her father found out about Atlantis in the hot zone, where he spent most of his time looking for ancient ruins for Atlantis and this advanced civilization from before recorded history, the lost civilization, as it were. These things are undeniable, but it was all a break. You know, I do a certain amount of research and I feel good about the research that I do around mystery stuff. This is from a court case. I didn't have to do anything except connect the fact that Cousteau and Minsky and Sanders are all related to this. So now here's the question to summarize and really give you the good answer. What does Alexandra Cousteau, Margaret Minsky, Marvin Minsky, and Margaret Sanders, what do they all have in common? And the answer is the hot zone in Atlantis. But there they are mixed in directly with Maxwell and Epstein, and Maxwell and Epstein need their information for their Belial cult Atlantis research.
There's so many connections.
Amazing.
It is.
Once in a while when you do this, you know, the kind of work that I do and that we do, you get blown away. That was a TKO.
TKO. TKO.
All right, are you ready for another one? During the time after Jeffrey Epstein's arrest, but before she was arrested in Bradford, New Hampshire by the FBI, Ghislaine Maxwell was using the alias Janet Marshall to purchase her hideout and was identifying herself as Janet Marshall, writer and journalist, to anyone who would listen. Well, the odd thing is that the real author, Janet Marshall, who passed away in 2009, her real name was Janet Atlantis. In fact, she wrote several plays under that name, Janet Atlantis. Somehow Ghislaine was tapped into all that and really using the steganography. And it's stranger still that the real Janet Atlantis had a mother named Atlantis Octavia. And we know Octavia in Latin means eight, and Atlantis is called the eighth continent. So when the question arose about why she was using the author's name, some Ghislaine faithful would say, well, that must have been her favorite author. Really? Janet Atlantis. You see, it goes really deep, but let's keep going here with your questions.
TKO.
What's going on there?
So what is AUTEC, the Atlantic Undersea Test and Evaluation Center, and who operates it in the hot zone?
This is one of the strangest groups, probably one of the most clandestine operations that the United States government funds. It's basically the underwater Area 51, and it's right there off of Andros Island. And Andros is just right near Bimini. It's like, you know, you can look right across the water at it. And Andros is unusual because there's also a lot of stories about ruins around Andros. Now, AUTEC, there's a lot of strange stories from people who've come out of AUTEC and talked about the type of experiments that they do in there. But magnetic experiments, anti-gravity experiments, completely under the cloak and offshore, so you would never really know or be able to figure out exactly what was going on. When we get into AUTEC and their presence there, they are this gigantic clandestine operation for 50 years operating where? Directly in the hot zone. Their other location is off Cuba. Okay, so this is the heart of what they do. So, you know, the idea that they're checking out different types of missile launches and things like that, they're testing ocean currents and all the rest, that's the cover story. The deeper research that they're doing has to do with UFO technology and operating something that has to do with seemingly technology that operates there in the hot zone. And this is another aspect of it. When you get around the hot zone, one of the researchers, I was able to talk to a number of Atlantean researchers or people who were open to that idea. And the things that they would tell me is you get to a certain spot down there and your compasses start spinning backwards. So if you're around Bimini, you're around the Bahamas, these things happen on a routine basis. Obviously, there's some what we call apothem effect that goes on there. Now, I'll tell you what's strange about that. If you go into that Casey story that we referred to earlier, Casey talks about the Two-Eye Stone, and what does it do? It starts pulling things down. That's the Casey story, that originally they used it to fly things and that they used it as a power station. At a certain point, it goes into reverse, and it starts pulling things down, including the landmass. So there's something about that area that has the same type of unusual physics signature that we see around the UFO file or X technology. The UFO file, when you get around AUTEC, they have all these sightings down there. So the question could be, are they reverse engineering the UFO technology and operating it down there? Is that why the Bahamas and Bimini have the highest incidence of UFO sightings anywhere else in the world, except for, you know, New Mexico and Arizona. And, you know, we have Area 51 and White Sands and all that over there. Okay, you can see it. But in the Bahamas? They're so common in Bimini that they call them fireflies.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, you know you're deep into it. AUTEC is the major center for their development, and they operate under a total cloak of secrecy. So when you get around AUTEC, you're very close to that breakaway aspect of the technology. And for my my opinion on it, when looking at AUTEC, is that they're operating directly with those two factors that are involved in UFO file research. The two factors are this reality distortion physics of apothem on one hand and the development of advanced technology on the other.
I have so many more questions.
Not a place you'd want to visit.
No. So So digging a little deeper into Cuba, who is ocean engineer Paula Zelitsky, and what did she discover off of the western tip of Cuba in 2001?
I think this is one of the biggest scandals in archaeology, and it's a bizarre story. And I've communicated with Paulina. She is a very interesting person, and she has a very interesting career going all the way back to the Soviet Union and defecting from the Soviet Union, from them bringing her to Cuba in the 60s, going to Canada, starting her own company, and then Fidel Castro hiring her to map the ocean floor, supposedly looking for, this is a very interesting code word, Spanish galleons. And I should say at this point, Spanish galleons are, you know, they're kind of that very interesting code word, because you can be looking for anything, and you say, well, I'm looking for Spanish galleons because they're known to have all these different wrecks. But if a government goes down there and they don't want the public to know that they're doing all this research about an ancient culture that they haven't fessed up to, then they're going to say, we're looking for Spanish galleons. So Spanish galleons becomes that interesting. You'll find it pop up more and more as a cover term as we go. So Paulina, she had this very interesting background. And Castro had said, I want you to come down here off the coast of Cuba and look for Spanish galleons for me. So she took her group down there, exactly, and took us into this whole kind of strange story that begins with her finding a metropolis, not just one structure, not just the Bimini Road, but an actual entire metropolis of ancient artifacts off the western tip. So she sends those submersibles down, and she's doing interviews. It's starting to hit places like the New York Times, like the Washington Post. And she says, oh, yeah, they're like pyramids, and they have this, you know, hieroglyphs on them. And the person is like, oh, they're like, you know, the reporter's saying, are they Egyptian hieroglyphs? Is that what you're talking about? And she says, no, they're like Mayan hieroglyphs and like Mayan pyramids. The whole thing looks like a Mayan city. So the story starts to hit. Everyone's like, did she find Atlantis? The mother lode and all the rest of it. Well, very strangely, Castro and the Cuban Navy boots her in the middle of all this research, boots her out. And she goes to Mexico as part of leaving there. And they grab her in Mexico on a phony charge of, like, you know, spying on some company or some nonsense. Keep her in a Mexican jail for 30 days to scare the bejesus out of her. And she escapes eventually. They let her go, but, you know, with a warning, like, we don't want you, and we don't want you, what you know about the hot zone. Just get out. She goes back to Canada. The story, archaeology drops the ball. The New York Times, the Washington Post, who had to cover it because the original stories came out of Cuba, it was already hitting worldwide, there was nothing they could do about it, they just stopped paying attention. However, she had video, photography, witness statements, the whole bit. And that entire city that she found off of Cuba is exactly what the types of things that Casey said would be found there. Yeah. And this is the nature of the hot zone. There's a lot of cloak and dagger activity that's going on. But if you can cover up something like that, you're pretty good. National Geographic did a special when it originally came out. They thought, we're going to have to deal with this. Well, everybody got shunted off of it. And, you know, National Geographic is about as bought off as you can get.
Yeah.
So for them to have to deal with it was pretty major. Now, an interesting follow-up on Zelitsky. When I talked to her, I said, I want you to bring this story back out, and I think it's a disgrace that archaeology let you and this entire story just drift away. I mean, come on. This is a huge cover-up coming out of Cuba. And she said, I don't think you can ever change, basically. Mm. And she said, I'll think about it, you know. And we haven't been able to connect in that way, but I still hope that she will come forward with the rest of her discoveries. By the way, she put a lot on the record already, which fits exactly the story that we're talking here about the hot zone. And one of the images of the city that she found, I can show you actually right now. There it is. I mean, that's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah.
And she has an incredible scientific background. There are a number of sonar images like this. She had deep sea submersibles. This is part of an ancient city off the coast of Cuba, which changes our entire understanding of history. So here we are Paulina Zelitsky found it, and it's in the hot zone. And if we follow those threads, there's enough there. This is why you have people like Epstein taking Hawking down in Atlantis submarines. This is what they're after. And that's the nature of the discoveries that we find in the hot zone. It's absolutely extraordinary. It's history changing. And the problem with it is the establishment and the established archaeological paradigm doesn't want to share those discoveries. Somebody, probably the Cuban government, isn't sharing it with the United States government. And the United States government wants their own, they want to change and alter that situation. There's a geopolitical clash on top right now. We have a number of sanctions on Cuba. You can always refer to economic and political tensions through one lens or another, but what if we look at it through the lens that they want access to the city and Cuba won't give it to them? So you can see when we get into the hot zone, you're dealing with a huge, huge story that goes back decades. And we have a number of characters from Hemingway to Marvin Minsky, yeah, to Ghislaine Maxwell, to our friend Paulina Zelitsky. These are real people, have gone through real stories, and the evidence is overwhelming. There's gigantic archaeological ruins there in the hot zone between Bimini, Miami, the Yucatan, and the western tip of Cuba. It's undeniable.
That's insane. It is.
I agree.
Okay. So the anti-gravity scientist, Thomas Townsend Brown, figures heavily into your research on the UFO file in the hot zone. What is his connection to all of these secret discoveries?
So Thomas Townsend Brown is probably that one figure that pulls in advanced technology, the UFO file, and the hot zone, all in one thing. And it is through my conversations with his daughter over the years that I've been able to glean things that aren't in books in relation to him. Some of the things that we know about him also relate directly to the hot zone. First off, he developed the Brown Byfield effect. And this is a very interesting thing in physics, where it's all about these different fields of magnetism. And he's well known for picking that up in his 20s, which is quite remarkable. Now, the Navy wanted him, and they pulled him in, and they bring him over to Cuba in 1930. Now, just as he gets there, an earthquake happens, a massive earthquake in Cuba. That's the first oddness. The second thing is, instead of having his normal mission, they say, we want you to go out to this yacht called the Caroline. It's just hanging there offshore, and meet this gentleman, and he's going to tell you some things. So T.T. Brown goes out there, and according to his daughter, the first thing this guy who's on the Caroline yacht shows him is the original copy of Alice in Wonderland. And it's in this glass casing, and T.T. Brown is like, you know, this is fascinating. I'd like to look at it. Why is it sort of locked up in this glass case, you know, just to preserve it? And the owner of the yacht says, if the yacht goes down, this copy will survive. It's a very weird trip that they're laying on him very early on. I found out later that the guy who was on the Caroline yacht will go to America to show Calvin Coolidge, the president, this copy of Alice in Wonderland. Everybody's really into this original copy. So T.T. Brown gets these instructions to operate a submersible in western Cuba, which is exactly where Zelitsky will pick it up later and find those ruins. And he goes down there and he does this high-level experiment. Later, his family will say, well, you know, for years, he would go down to San Antonio, and he was hanging out down there, and he was with his best friend, Robert Sarbarker, who's the physicist that's kind of wiped out of history because he talked too much about the UFO file. And we brought him up last time, so I think we covered him pretty well. But what's interesting is, when he goes down to San Antonio, they think he's going to Cuba. I mean, to Texas, because San Antonio, Texas, every year for a month, he goes down with his friend to San Antonio. It turns out all of those years, they found out after he died, that he was actually going to San Antonio, Cuba. San Antonio, Cuba is on the western tip of Cuba, and it's exactly where Zelitsky does her jump-off point for finding the city. So T.T. Brown, very early on, operating in the hot zone, probably looking for the exact same ruins that we're talking about here. One of the other things she told me is that he liked studying the very white, fine sand in San Antonio, Cuba. So T.T. Brown brings in a number of different things, and I'll run through them quickly. He's a big part of the Philadelphia experiment, one. Two, he's a big thing, there's a big thing associated with him called the acoustic fan. And the acoustic fan is a strange development that he made. And his daughter told me about being his assistant when he was demonstrating this for the RAND Corporation and high-level military officials. What it was supposed to have the ability to do was if you stood in front of it, you could see your entire life, the beginning to the end. And there were other qualities about it acoustically that if they played something to you, music, speech, whatever it happened to be, tones, after you left, the tones would be with you for 4 days, the speech would be with you for 4 days, the music would be with you for 4 days. You know, we hear so much about voice-to-skull technology that the government has now. I have no doubt that they had T.T. Brown working on these things. So when he demonstrates the acoustic fan, and remember, he's in the heart of time travel experiments for the government because they're very serious about it. Project Invisibility, the Philadelphia experiment, that's all T.T. Brown. He's one of the, you know, he's the scientist who worked on the most kind of black projects. But there, according to her, he had qualms with his conscience about how they would use it. So what she said was that he basically said, when he demonstrated the fan, he told her, guess what, honey, you're going to Europe. Forget about the acoustic fan. Forget about the demonstration we gave at the RAND Corporation. You're out of here. Go have a nice life. So she did. No more experiments with dad, none of that stuff. Never talking about the fan ever again.
Wow.
Whatever the fan was, whatever technology that he had developed, was so it was so upsetting to the establishment, and the nature of the secrecy was so heavy, that what he ends up doing is taking his whole family to Eleuthera Island. And her flashbacks were, you know what? All I can remember is all these people around with machine guns. And they were protecting us on Eleuthera Island in the heart of the hot zone. And T.T. Brown said, we're going to be here for a little while. Don't even talk about it. You know, just have a nice little hangout vacation, then you're going to college. So whatever it was that Brown unleashed in the middle of his technology, he didn't want them to use. And the groups that were involved, it's like the groups that I've identified, like X-Protect, who wanted to use it for other purposes, he didn't want to go any further in the research, and obviously they threatened him. He took off. Mm. So T.T. Brown gets us right into the heart of this conversation, and the question is, was he down there in San Antonio, Cuba, looking at the same ruins as Paulina Zelitsky brought up in the heart of this breakaway technology? Well, what did he spend most of his life doing publicly? Sponsoring UFO groups. He created NICAP. He was in the middle of developing the whole 50s and 60s UFO identification groups. So if that's the guy who's the deep player on the government side, but who had a conscience, I call those people X-Share as opposed to X-Protect, I think it gives us a huge hint through one individual about the nature of this level of research. And I call that level apotheum, because it has to do somewhere with the unusual things going on there in the hot zone, the UFO file technology that they're using, and this uncontrollable X technology that they're trying to master, which you see in the work of, for example, Nikola Tesla. So Brown is absolute showstopper when it gets to this kind of research.
Okay. Next question. What is the role of NASA in the hot zone, and what is a controversy involving the famous Gemini astronaut Gordon Cooper finding Linnean ruins?
This is pretty amazing, if you think about it. Okay, Cooper, we've covered in a number of episodes because of his unusual NASA activities. And also the fact that he thought he was manning a mission to Mars by 1981, but didn't turn out that way. And he was like, how did they stop the manned moon missions? He was also had seen many UFOs. He had filmed UFOs. He was a very deep insider on the UFO file. He wanted it public. And he wrote a letter to the UN saying, you know what, We need to make this stuff public, and I'm here with the president of Grenada. We're both signing off on this. So they submit that to the UN, and then a little while later, the US invades Grenada. Are you guys looking into UFOs? Forget it. You know, we're taking over. That happens in 1983. Very strange. But Cooper is fascinating on the Atlantis part because he's up there, and while he's on these different missions, during the JFK, he's known as JFK's inside astronaut. He's the guy in NASA who JFK has promoted into these positions. And JFK says, I want you to look over in the hot zone, and I want you to, you know, take a look at everything that's going on down there. Now, it's after the Cuban Missile Crisis, so they're not looking for missile sites anymore. Very often it's blown off and said, well, he had him up there, he was looking for nukes. It's not the way you would look for nukes in the first place. And also, their nuclear threat. They had already negotiated removing the missiles and all the rest. So he's up there, and he puts together a number of coordinates for unusual things that he's seeing on the ground. Years later, he tells people, well, there's some unusual Spanish galleons down there. And
well, then.
So it's quite interesting indeed that when he leaves NASA, he goes to Central America hunting ancient ruins and says, these cultures were way more advanced than we realized at the time. Now, Discovery Channel, this guy who was a researcher named Miklos, said, you know, I knew him and my dad knew him and he gave me his secret notes about the coordinates that he kept and we're going to go looking for these Spanish galleons. Member of Spanish galleons. So they made a whole show out of it called Cooper's Treasures, about them looking for this stuff. Hmm. In the middle of the show, the researcher who's doing this says, one of the coordinates led me to this unusual structure. I think this is a UFO underwater in the hot zone in the Bahamas. And they have pictures of it. It's a very unusual structure that's under there that he's identified, whatever it is. But apparently, this was one of the structures that Cooper saw when he was flying around in that craft originally. The person who sent him up there was John F. Kennedy. Now, Kennedy has a very keen interest in all things outside of the box, whether it relates to space. You know, he's very advanced on this. He wants the intel around a number of different things. This is why he's such a threat. Beyond his political activities. Well, if you go in to the Kennedy Library today, guess what the largest collection of information that they have anywhere in the world for a famous author is?
Bring it.
Ernest Hemingway. Now, here's an interesting
thing. How did
that happen? If you go and look for an Ernest Hemingway museum, you're going to find it. It's all in the JFK Library here. And I've been there and spent many hours there going through all of that. Now, very interestingly, in short, JFK, very early on, was part of naval intelligence. And also Hemingway was part of naval intelligence very early on. The idea of an exchange there and the amount of how Cuba impacted their lives, I found very interesting as a crossover. So I went looking into how all that stuff from Hemingway got to the library. And it's very interesting because there's a whole thing about his widow saying, all of the stuff that we had to abandon in Cuba, it's in our house, our villa there, Finca Vieja. So there's a document that comes out in 2015, and it says, Kennedy gets together with Ed Lansdale, the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, his brother, and the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And he says, we need to do this national security incident inside Finca Vieja. And you go to all these Kennedy historians, and they're like, we don't know anything about a national security incident inside of Hemingway's place. What are you talking about? If you dig through that story, you find that Kennedy risked everything to get what was in Hemingway's vault out of Cuba. Now, remember what I said earlier about what Hemingway was actually doing there. I don't think he's going to risk national security to get a bunch of poems from Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah.
But if Hemingway had been mapping out the hot zone for years and years with his brother using submarines and scientific equipment between Bimini and Cuba, that would be pretty valuable. And in fact, what they ended up doing was getting it and smuggling it on a shrimp boat back to the United States. So basically, as repayment for all of this, they take all of Hemingway's stuff and they put it in the JFK library. But what we have is a big overarching question. Why is the repository of Hemingway's info there? The connections in the hot zone run exactly like this. If you go even a little bit, like 6 to 8 inches deep on this, it is absolutely fascinating because you're going to find yourself surrounded by advanced technology, advanced scientists, blackmail, the UFO file, Kennedy, Hemingway, they're all there. And there are a lot of unanswered questions about why these things are linked. And as a matter of fact, the original special that I did on Hemingway was before they did the PBS special on it. Hmm. And I think that a lot of the research we put out there about Kennedy and Hemingway had somebody thinking, hey, we have to go down there and check this out. Just like right now we're seeing this Netflix fascination with Danny Casolaro,
yeah,
and this whole thing, which is something that myself and other researchers have reported on for years. The point is, on that superstructure, marketing-wise, the stories and all the rest of it, the danger is for them to have counterfeit versions of these things come out, which is why I think the hot zone story is so important, because just like we have phony CIA people running around telling, oh, I'm the CIA UFO whistleblower, I'll tell you everything, you know, they called me up, as you know, and they're running those stories through Congress and everything else, well, they'll have a phony Atlantis story ready, too. Atlantis disclosure is coming your way via Netflix. That's not the real thing. And we need to make some kind of distinction in this research by going back and seeing the thread is already there out there. And we started it, you know, with the mystery schools and the Casey work. Now we're bringing it all around. And I think the facts on the ground is there's something undeniable about the fact that they're involved in major operations in the hot zone. And these are the reasons that I think they're down there for, the ancient ruins and the UFO file.
It's all coming together. So coming back to Casey, what did Casey say would be found beneath the right paw of the Sphinx? And when did he actually predict it would be found?
This is fascinating. And, you know, Casey put this on the record. I want to say what an innovator Casey is when we look back at his work. Casey is saying underneath the right paw of the Sphinx is the Atlantean Hall of Records. So, somehow, in the setup of that structure, which he says is 10,500 years old, not 2,500 years old, there's 8,000 years of difference there. And he said the fleeing Atlanteans came in and deposited their information about the Two-Eye Stone, their information about the entire history of the Atlantean culture, and that Egypt was a legacy culture of Atlantis. Well, interestingly enough, the people who directed the Giza complex, if you go back into their histories a little bit, Giza in Egypt, which are the pyramids and the Sphinx, and I call this Giza Gate, because they were originally part of the Casey Foundation.
Oh, okay.
Zahi Hawass and Mark Lehner. And Lehner was somebody that was a high school dropout that the Casey Foundation was like, hey, we'll put you through college, you can be our man in Cairo. And he went through it. He went, you know, University of Chicago, all this elite stuff. They put him over there. And he's there for a little while. And then suddenly he becomes the guy who says, there's no such thing as a Hall of Records. You know, it's traditional archaeological dating all the way. These other researchers are wrong. Now, a guy named Robert Schock comes out. He's a geologist. And he says, you know what? There's weather watering on the Sphinx that comes from rain. And they haven't had rain since 10,500 BC, which is exactly, you know, where Casey places it loosely, Plato places it, the mystery schools, they all have it back there. Well, here's geological proof. What do they do with that guy? They ban him from the Giza complex. And then Zahi Hawass, who the Casey Foundation helped put through school also, he becomes part of the Mubarak government at the time, corrupt regime, which is eventually thrown out, and that's why you have a military dictatorship now in Egypt. He kicks people who are researching this off the Giza Plateau. He discourages it and says, oh, there is no Hall of Records, you know, it's just built by Egyptians. And they go absolutely psychotic trying to keep people away from this story. But at the same time, they accept money, do lectures at, and were sponsored by the Casey Foundation originally. So while making fun of that on the public surface, these are the guys who are the greatest recipients of Casey's organization. So, and you could say that the Casey organization are suckers for paying these guys money when they publicly disparage Casey's work, and they block people from getting to the bottom of it. But apparently the Casey people think at one point, you know, these guys will actually help us out. Well, Lehner retired. He's here. He's, you know, Boston University.
Oh, wow.
And Zahi Hawass, you know, National Geographic and all that kind of stuff. The point really is that the Hall of Records being there under the Sphinx, Casey's story is simple. The Atlanteans, when they fled, they placed their records there in Egypt, but they also placed them off the coast of Bimini. It wasn't the coast then. And they placed them in a temple there, and they placed them in Yucatan. So the other two major hotspots that we talk about in relation to the hot zone, off the coast of Bimini, the Yucatan. Mm. Both of them are right there in the hot zone, and they are the other two places of the Hall of Records. So if you don't get them at the Sphinx, because they've blocked off the Sphinx from serious research, those other two are available. That's another reason why the hot zone is such a political, geopolitical tension spot, because when you get into it, again, you're talking about the same piece of information. These archaeology wars stretch out over continents. So Casey says, hey, the records are the same in all three places, under the Sphinx, off the coast of Bimini, and in the Yucatan. Well, we have two out of three we can check.
I'm ready for it. This is fascinating, like you said. Okay. So how does the concept of land rising and a pole shift relate to the potential discovery of the advanced lost civilization of Atlantis?
You know, this is fascinating, and it's the crux, really, of what we've been talking about. Because the reason all these scientists are involved, the reason all of these elite subterranean groups are involved, the clandestine operations, all relate to the fact that in the heart of this research of the mystery schools, Casey, and the hot zone, it's all about land rising. It's the whole reason why we can see those ruins now, is because that land is rising. You hear a lot in the media about coasts rising, and you're going to be underwater on this coast, and we have this climate issue and all the rest. Well, in tandem with that is actual land rising. You don't hear much about that. Because if land rises, for example, in the Atlantic Ocean, it's international waters. It's anybody's game. Mm. Les Hemingway, when he bought lots in the Atlantic Ocean, set up New Atlantis for a period there before it was destroyed and the government said, get out of there and don't do that. He thought these people were plugged into that story of land rising also. I found out that John Lennon bought lots in the Atlantic Ocean because he thought land was rising there. And when it rises, what happens? It's wide open. Anybody, it's a free country, basically. It's anybody's ball game. So if this stuff is already rising, they are already on top of it. So who's observing? Who would be the people observing that? Stephen Hawking was down there, the late Stephen Hawking. Epstein with his scientists and all the rest. What are they doing down there? They're watching the land rising. And when it rises, what does it reveal? An ancient past that we know nothing about. But land rising is connected with the idea of a pole shift. And what they are thinking is that just as Atlantis went down because of a massive natural destruction, that we are going to face the same type of thing, and they want to be well positioned for it. That's why the scientific part is so key. That's why blackmailing scientists or people like Alexandre Cousteau figures into this picture. So for me, land rising is a key aspect to understanding. So land rising and the pole shift, now we understand their motivation quite well.
So Daniel, putting it all together, what can we expect to be revealed based on your Hot Zone Atlantis sonography research that will change our entire understanding of our ancient past and literally change history, entire history?
Yeah, this is really quite fascinating, because if we become aware of the fact that we were already in advanced culture, that culture destroyed itself, and that we are the remnants of that, went through our own dark ages, and we rediscover it. There's a lot of suggestions that things like the pyramids and other structures that are so advanced are an ancient advanced culture communicating with mathematics, geometry, and all the rest of it, not through language, but saying, well, at some point in the future, a culture will come along, they'll have discovered what we did, and this is our way of communicating with them. But for me, you know, the idea of Atlantis, sometimes people say, well, the idea of aliens or UFOs would be the biggest story that humanity ever faced. It's actually not true. The biggest story would be if humanity itself had an advanced past that was completely unknown. And as Graham Hancock, who's a researcher that we've had up here talking about Atlantis, says, one of his famous quotes is, we're a culture with amnesia. So if we are a culture with amnesia, and there was this tremendous technological innovation in the ancient past related somehow to spiritual advancement, and then they essentially blew themselves up, then we're looking at something now which is a recapturing of that memory. It would change everything that we understand about history. So therefore, everything that goes on in the hot zone, I can give you trails and facts for. There's no question that this is a decades-long process, probably centuries-long process, of getting a handle on that disclosure and the human origin question in relation to humanity. For me, what it's going to reveal is you had an advanced culture back there. Like it or not, history has to be changed. And by the way, the idea that they had advanced technology would help us to understand why things like the pyramids and the Sphinx and all these other buildings that we see all across the world are still there as an echo. So it's probably the kind of research that you could do in a number of different places. But if you're in the hot zone, to me, you're at the apex of where the nature of this thing is going to be revealed. And they know it. That's why those scientists were involved. That's why we've seen this tapestry of individuals involved in looking for this information. And they've utilized what? Psychic information, remote viewing, advanced technology, AUTEC, the UFO file, remote viewing. This is how important this is to them. So I think if we as a culture get on the same page, we can beat the whole misinformation streak that's going to come from the establishment on this. And for me, that's a dramatic difference as far as the future is concerned. So Atlantis, in terms of the research that I've done, is absolutely a reality. I think the mystery schools and the Casey work and all the rest were trying to give us that heads up, as a culture, take a look into this because it's important.
All the signs were there.
Exactly.
I mean, so the mystery just gets deeper.
I would agree with you. Absolutely. And the deeper it gets, the more inclined I am to study it.